Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
For me, lunch is the best time to introduce kids to new food because they're a captive audience.
That's professor in residence at the University of California, Irvine, Mimi Ito, who packs and then photographs her kids' lunches. In part one of our look at school lunches, she talks about why posting these photographs on her Bento blog is valuable for both mother and child. Hello and welcome. I'm Annie Corrigan. In the kitchen today, Chef Daniel Orr starts the day off right with two easy breakfast dishes, and we visit the Oregon Truffle Festival, where a movement is underway to prove that truffles can be planted, managed, and harvested just like any other agricultural product. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. Bringing us the food headlines from this week is Mia Partlow, who's sitting in for Liz Leslie. Welcome, Mia.
Hey, Annie. Great to be with you. Big news for organic fans. The United States and the European Union signed a trade agreement standardizing organic foods. Before the agreement, what was considered organic in the U.S. wasn't considered organic in the EU, and vice versa. The move will almost certainly open up the market. Good news for job growth. McDonald's announced that they would stop using pork suppliers who crated their sows. Crating a pig means putting the animal in a cage barely bigger than itself, leading to a variety of health issues and general distress for the animal. Animal rights groups champion the move as McDonald's will make a significant blow for crating in the pork industry. Walmart is unveiling their Great For You sticker this spring. America's largest grocery store chain has developed standards to determine what foods are considered healthy, and those items will get the new bright green labels. Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University, is cautiously optimistic. She applauds the strict standards for what is considered healthy, but will this actually end up making people healthier? She's not so sure. And for those looking for an organic alternative to high fructose corn syrup, be warned. Researchers at Dartmouth College found levels of arsenic in organic brown rice syrup over that of the legal limit for water. Baby formula was tested for arsenic, and researchers found levels 20 times that legal in water. However, there is no standard currently in place for levels of arsenic in food. Read more about these stories and many more on our website, eartheats.org.
And follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Just search for Earth Eats. Mia Partlow, sitting in for news blogger Liz Leslie. Thanks so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
In the process of making food, there are lots of products that just aren't fit for human consumption. Hulls of oats, lower-grain soybean oil, vegetable trimmings, and even animal parts that can't be consumed as meat. But just like in the old days when they would be thrown to pigs as scraps, industry has found ways to recycle these massive amounts of would-be waste. And with today's high corn and grain prices, many farmers are interested in this less expensive kind of feed. Harvest Public Media's Kathleen Masterson reports.
Every factory that makes food, tomato sauce, oatmeal, cereals, pasta, has some kind of waste. In large-scale bakeries, sometimes loaves get burned or a batch gets misformulated. And it's actually cheaper for both factories and farmers to reuse this would-be waste in animal feed than it is to bury it in a landfill. Often more than 50% of livestock feed is being recycled in some way, says Iowa State University animal scientist Mike Persia.
Animal agriculture is one of the leaders in the green revolution, even though they never really touted that.
Persia says one common example is the oil waste from making soybean oil, the number one product made from soybeans. The oil that's below human grade gets added to livestock feed to fill the fat quotient of their diet. And oftentimes the livestock industry makes use of little things that you might not think of, but really add up. Like, where do all those seeds go that get removed from canned tomatoes?
I know I've done research evaluating tomato seeds, waste products of the tomato canning industry in poultry rations. So that's certainly both from a poultry and a dairy perspective something that can occur.
The market for food production cast-offs is big enough that middlemen have gotten into the business. For example, some ag companies buy bakery byproduct, bread, dough, and pastry seconds, and blend it to sell to farmers to mix into cattle feed. Ag Partners is one Iowa company that does this, but they didn't want to say where they purchase rejected baked goods. In fact, some cattlemen were wary to share details, too. Jeff Clausen manages 3,000 cattle in two feedlots in western Iowa.
Where do you get the bakery byproduct? I guess I'm a little bit sensitive about that because it's pretty competitive, not only between feedlots but also dog food companies in Omaha. They're kind of our competition.
Clausen says they use about 200 tons of bakery leftovers a week. It's not cheap, but he says the cost is usually about 70 or 80% the price of corn.
When corn's $2, it's not as big of an advantage to feed it. But when corn's $6 or $7, then everybody's looking for ways to get corn out of their ration.
With corn and grain prices fairly high, the demand for cheaper livestock feed isn't lost on food manufacturers. The Quaker Oats plant in Iowa, for example, has seen an increased interest in their oat and cereal leftovers. Tom Metelman is senior director of the Cedar Rapids plant.
You know, over the last few years, we've renegotiated a lot of our contracts to be a certain percentage of the corn or oat market, for example. So as the market moves, the value of our byproducts would move as well.
That means when corn prices go up, so does the price for those misformulated batches of oatmeal, Captain Crunch, and Life cereal. Cows and pigs munching on cereals doesn't seem too far-fetched, but even seconds from candy manufacturers make their way into animal feed. The Hershey Company, for one, sells their leftover chocolate to Cargill. But beyond carbs and calories, there's another large source of food waste, from meat processing. Everything from the animal carcass that isn't consumed by humans or doesn't go into pharmaceuticals or pet food gets rendered, says ISU's Mike Persia.
And basically that process is like a large pressure cooker. Uses high temperature and high steam to, you know, degrade the bones, degrade the tissue, any residual meat, any fat.
The meat, blood, and bone meal and the fat are then used in livestock feed, though federal rules bar cows from eating cows because of the risk of mad cow disease. What any individual farmer uses in his feed is partly based on his location and availability, or what company supplies the feed. Most develop specific formulas with their vet or animal nutritionist to get the right balance of nutrients. Some estimate this kind of food recycling saves thousands of tons from going into landfills every year. And that's not to mention the money it can save farmers, especially in the days of sky-high corn. I'm Kathleen Masterson, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. You know what they say, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Chef Daniel Orr couldn't agree more. He's preparing two easy and healthy dishes today, the first of which uses fresh citrus fruit.
I heard you didn't like grapefruit. So today we're going to come up with a grapefruit dish that hopefully you will like. Kind of like a grapefruit brulee. So basically all we do is we'll cut the grapefruit in half, and this is the ruby red grapefruit, which tend to be sweeter than a normal grapefruit. Cut this around the peel, so you're just doing kind of a circle, just kind of releasing the grapefruit from the peel, but leaving it inside. And then if you want to be fancy, you can go through and cut between each one of those little segments, and that will really make it easy to eat if you have a grapefruit spoon. All right, so then what we do is we take a little brown sugar. We're going to just kind of coat this with the brown sugar and then put it up under the broiler. If you have one of those little blow torches, you can also just use a little blowtorch on it, and you want it to caramelize. All right, so I'm going to just go put it up under the broiler. I'll have Chef Bob watch it for me until it gets nicely brown.
Yes, Chef. Yeah, who would have thought to broil a grapefruit?
I know.
Well, let me ask you. So who thought to broil a grapefruit?
My mom used to always make this for us. And it was a way to get kids to eat grapefruit. So,
so you're like a kid. You know what? I'm fine with that.
All right, and we're going to make this little broiled grapefruit into something a little more adult. I've got some griotines, which are brandied French cherries.
All right.
They're seedless sour cherries in a sugar brandy syrup. All right, I'm just going to put this in the serving dish. We'll put a few of these cherries on top, maybe just a little touch of the liquid, and that's it. That's our wonderful broiled grapefruit, and it'll make a grapefruit lover out of even the most timid of citrus people.
Okay, I'm keeping an open mind. Well, it's more palatable. Still not my favorite. It's tasty for someone who likes grapefruit.
Well, it's an old-timey dish, and I think a lot of people in the Midwest have grown up with this. This is steel-cut oats, and they take a lot longer to cook. And a lot of people, and a lot of times it will stick to the bottom of the pan. You know, you're there in the morning, and it takes 45 minutes to cook, so you don't have time. So I'm going to show you an easy way. What we do here is I have got a pan on. I'm going to put a little bit of oil in the pan, and then add about half a cup of oats, depending on how many people you're cooking for. And what we're going to do is just toast those a little bit. Well, what this does is it brings out kind of a nutty, smoky flavor. And you want them just to get a little bit brown and start to smoke a little bit. And they'll taste much more kind of nutty and smoky. Okay, so we let these toast. We're going to cover them with about an inch of water. All right, we're going to bring that back to the fire, bring that up to a boil. While we're waiting for that to boil, we're going to add some orange zest. And that's going to bring a little more intrigue and mystery to your oats. And once it boils, I'm going to add just a little bit of vanilla. Now, you want it to boil first because if you add this right now, a lot of the flavor will just go up into the air. So we're going to bring that to a boil. And the great thing about this recipe is you do it the night before. You just do this, you leave it on the stove overnight, and your steel-cut oats will be perfect in the morning. All right, so we've come to a full boil here. Going to add just about a teaspoon of vanilla, give it a good stir, bring it back to a rolling boil, and then just turn off the heat. And that's all there is to cooking breakfast. So to finish this off, I'm going to put just a little bit of brown sugar. And you don't need a lot of sugar and stuff when you have those extra flavors of the vanilla and the orange peel in there. They kind of make it an automatically appealing breakfast.
See photos of both of these finished dishes and check out the recipes to make some morning for yourself. Let us know how you like them by rating a comment on the website, eartheats.org. Coming up, we take a look at school lunches through the eyes of an especially tech-savvy mom. And we hop a plane to the Pacific Northwest to see how folks in Oregon are attempting to cultivate one of nature's rarest phenomenon, truffles. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, offering local, organic, and fair trade natural foods with cafe seating on East 3rd Street at the co-op's original location off Kirkwood and on West 6th Street, two blocks west of the Courthouse Square. Information at bloomingfoods.coop. And from Goods for Cooks, Bloomington's premier culinary arts store, offering hard-to-find and everyday kitchen items, serving Bloomington and the surrounding area since 1973, located downtown on the west side of the square and online at goodsforcooks.com.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Last month, First Lady Michelle Obama unveiled the most sweeping changes to school lunch standards in 15 years. These new guidelines include more fruits and vegetables, more whole grains, a gradual reduction of sodium over the next 10 years, limiting milk to no more than 1% fat, and a ban on most trans fats. Many critics applauded the move as a major step forward, even if pizza is still considered a vegetable. Over the next few weeks, Earth Eats will take a look at the school lunch program through the eyes of three people who live with it every day. Mimi Ito is an academic with a food habit. As professor in residence at the University of California, Irvine, she studies how social media and mobile technologies shape our everyday lives. As the mother of an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old, she is her family's resident cook, preparing lunches for her kids to take to school. She documents the lunches on her Bento blog, a Flickr account that includes photos of the meals along with a description. This project started in 2003 when her family moved from Japan to the U.S. and when her kids were in preschool. It was part of her early experimentation with camera phones. She recently stopped by the Earth Eats studios while speaking at Indiana University.
Well, it's interesting because we had done studies of camera phone use 10 years ago when it was first starting to take off in Japan. And one of the things that we found was really interesting is that amateur photographers were taking pictures that they never took before. So amateur photography used to be special events and travel. And now people start taking pictures of, like, food, what they're eating every day. That was one of the biggest genres of camera phone photography. And so I got really interested in just, you know, this issue of capturing mundane everyday things, having that heightened attention to your visual environment as part of your everyday life. And one of the things is, you know, I think that women's work and everyday mundane work is not considered something for public celebration as much as it should be. So that was part of my reason of saying, look, you know, I perform this labor, you know, I do this craft work every day, and I want to share it and be proud of it and have it as part of a community of people inspiring each other about those mundane everyday things that get forgotten in that stream of everyday life.
Well, let's take a look at one of the meals that you made, it looks like, for your daughter recently. This was from September 6th of this year. I'm going to show this to you. It's adorable. Oh. So there's the highlight of this is that there's a smiley face that looks like it's been made out of seaweed.
Right. So this is a funny one because this is actually the first one that my daughter made herself.
Oh, nice.
She just decided in Japan there's bentos, but then there's keraben character bentos, like the really cute ones that are usually made for small children. But she decided that she wanted to start making these, so she did it.
Tell me what's in this dish.
So this was kind of an amalgam of just stuff we had at home because, you know, one of the things about a keraben is you have to have lots of little pieces and it has to be cute. So she has rice that's mixed with salmon and in the shape of a little bear face, corn, an egg omelet, which I made, and then okra and some shumai.
What I love is imagining her eating this at a cafeteria table with her classmates who are eating chicken nuggets and french fries and having a soda. Have you talked to your kids about how their classmates react to this being their lunch?
It was actually a big problem in the early years when the kids were smaller and maybe through early elementary. My daughter started coming home without having eaten her lunch. And then she said that the kids would say, "What's that? What's that?" And which was another motivation for the bento blog, right? Just to be proud of what she's eating and think of it as beautiful and healthy, you know.
Let's talk about school lunch as a whole. I'm wondering how school lunches would have to change in order for you to feel comfortable having your kids eat that instead of you having to make this.
The biggest problem I have is not that they'll occasionally eat like a chicken nugget or a tater tot, but the lack of variability in the diet is unfortunate. So even at our school now, which has decent lunches, that I will get them those lunches every once in a while, especially when I'm traveling, it's like the same cycle of, you know, orange chicken wrap, hamburger, pizza, and it cycles through. It's the same thing every month. And that's where, I mean, for me, lunch is the best time to introduce kids to new food because they're a captive audience. And at most, the first five times it comes back uneaten, but by time six or seven. And that encourages them to try and experiment. And I think I read it in some parenting book. You don't really know if you like or don't like a food unless you've tried it at least 9 to 12 times. I don't know if that's true.
I read in an interview you did in 2007 in The Guardian. You said, quote, "Packing a bento for my kids is like making them a little present every day." So I read that and I thought, you know, I bet a lot of Americans out there would think that chicken nuggets and soda and french fries would be more of a present for lunch than this fresh green okra that we're looking at, than broccoli, than rice. Talk about how your mentality differs from that.
Well, I think it's probably the Japanese mom thing that putting effort and crafting effort into things like that, whether it's bento or making little homemade things, is just part of the aesthetic. It's the effort that goes into it. You know, plus I have pretty strong feelings about nutrition and health and food too. So it's a way of transmitting my own values.
Look ahead 5 years, 7 years, when your kids turn 18, they leave the house to go live on their own. What food values are you really hoping they take with them?
So I think, you know, for me, I have an interest in food. I think it's a site where, you know, it's almost a site of activism for me. So I tend to load a lot of values into how we eat and prepare and enjoy food. I think, you know, the openness to experimentation, using food as a way to explore culture and life and experience is really a key value in our family. And bringing people together around food and the enjoyment of food is a way of slowing the pace of life in a way that I really appreciate.
You can see what Mimi Ito's kids are eating for lunch these days on her Bento blog. Find a link to the blog and see a photo of her daughter's first attempt at making her own kata ben on our website, eartheats.org. It can be a lucrative business hunting for truffles, as they commonly sell for $1,000 per pound. But finding them is a trick. Their growth is considered a rare natural phenomenon found primarily in France and Italy, and you need to employ the skills of a pig to find them. Well, folks in Oregon are trying to show that truffles can be planted, managed, and harvested just like any other agricultural product. Chef Daniel Orr went on a field trip to Eugene, Oregon to attend the annual Oregon Truffle Festival. Their truffière, or truffle field, is located near a number of local wineries by the Willamette River. The festivities include a truffle hunt, seminars for training your dog to sniff out truffles, and a grand truffle dinner. One of the founders of the festival is Dr. Charles Lefevre. He's also perhaps the world's foremost culinary truffle cultivator. His job is to work with trees that are known to be good truffle hosts and then plant those in truffières across the country. He's also leading the festival participants and their dogs on a hunt for this reclusive delicacy.
I make my living with the European truffles. And I had French truffles in my refrigerator. But of course, I live in Oregon, so I had Oregon truffles in my refrigerator right next to the French truffles. And I had always been told that the Oregon truffles were weak. They had no aroma. But the reality is that they're actually very, very good. And the culinary experience is very, very good, and they're served well with the right foods. So it struck me as an opportunity to redeem them. So I was looking for that opportunity of a truffle patch where we could actually bring people and have them have the experience of finding truffles. I will do a little demonstration of how to find truffles inside, just inside the woods. Just gather around right here. The way I know that there are truffles in the ground right here is because of the holes that the squirrels and mice have dug. Of course, everywhere that you see a hole and fresh dirt, that truffle is gone. But it tells you that the truffles tend to be clumped, and there are likely to be more, all of its friends. If you find a place that has lots of these little holes, I tend to start back away from them and work toward it. I'm raking down to the mineral soil through all of the organic layer, because the truffles are right at the interface between the organic and mineral layers. And hopefully there actually is a truffle here. There's a truffle. This is a very small one, but that's an Oregon white truffle. I can just see that this is a spring white truffle. They have these white lines on the surface. But the spring whites have no culinary value at this time of year. So have at it.
Swap them around.
And yes, please do swap the rakes around. Share the rakes.
Share the rakes.
If you find the little ones, leave them back down. You don't know if it's going to re-pollinate or not. But, you know, go back to little fish. You know, catch and release. With my dog, I'm watching for different
signs. It's an odd coincidence that there's a molecule in a right truffle that exactly mimics a molecule in a sex pheromone of a pig. So that's one reason why pigs are attracted. But pigs can weigh hundreds of pounds. And if you're walking your pig down the road in Italy, it might be a pretty good indication to people what you're about to do. And, of course, it's a pretty well-guarded secret where you find your truffles. So, you know, hundreds of years ago, it was such a well-kept secret that a man would not even tell his firstborn son the location until his deathbed.
Oh,
no, you need it.
Well, there's three basic steps to teaching a dog to find anything with its nose. The first thing you want to do is imprint the scent. The dog has to understand that's the smell we're looking for. The second step is to then hide it, you know, like under some loose leaf litter so he visually can't see it, but he needs to locate it with his nose. The third and probably the most difficult step is you have to train a separate alert, which means he needs to let me know in some overt fashion that he's located a truffle. It could be a bark. I use where they actually start scratching the soil in a digging motion, and then I immediately call them off and reward them, and then I go over where they indicated where it was and find it.
And now she's given me two signs that definitely mean there's truffles around. Stand on the side of a tree, and then where she'll just kind of stand over and say, this is ownership here, but you want it. I'll run off to the next tree. And she'll do that like to three trees. That's really fun. So for
that sounds awesome. Makes me want to get a dog.
Basically, what's been discovered recently are there two different mating types that exist in the truffle, in the black truffle, and you have to have the two of those come together to get truffles to form. And this is new information, absolutely new for scientists. And it has pretty important implications for whether a truffier or a tree is going to be productive or not.
Is there anything kinky about truffle sex?
You know, the whole fungal life cycle is so different from the human life cycle that, okay, here, I'll tell you what it is. If we were like fungi, we would spend all of our lives as a sperm and an egg, and then when we got ready to reproduce, we would fuse to form a human, and then 2 seconds later, we would be back to being sperm and eggs again. That's what fungi do.
I grew up in this landscape, so I look out over these hills and these trees and these oak trees, and I identify with it. I'm made of this place. I'm made of this soil. So it's very interesting for me that I see that these glorious wines and truffles, and it's all coming from this same earth. It's all made of the same stuff that I am, and it's very interesting how seeing delicacies come from the same soil that one is made of can actually affect one's perception of oneself. And it might explain how so many Europeans are so proud of the places that they come from and why they all think that their place is the absolute best place in the world, because they see the other stuff that comes from it.
Charles Lefevre is co-founder of the Oregon Truffle Festival. Shannon Birch is an ecologist studying reproduction of mushrooms. Jim Sanford of Blackberry Farms is the handler for North America's only professional truffle dog. And Dee Dee Dalsred was accompanied on the hunt by her dog, Cami. Thanks to Daniel Orr and all the folks at the Oregon Truffle Festival.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, offering local, organic, and fair trade natural foods with cafe seating on East 3rd Street at the co-op's original location off Kirkwood and on West 6th Street, 2 blocks west of the Courthouse Square. Information at bloomingfoods.coop. And from Goods for Cooks, Bloomington's premier culinary arts store, offering hard-to-find and everyday kitchen items, serving Bloomington and the surrounding area since 1973. Located downtown on the west side of the square and online at goodsforcooks.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Next week, three soups to warm you up on the remaining cold days. And author Janet Poppendick gives us a history lesson about how the school lunch program got started in the first place. In the meantime, visit our website for recipes, news stories, and interviews. It's all at eartheats.org. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.